Good morning. I have to admit that I thought I kind of had the preaching thing, like I had it figured out. And then I came to this text and I wrestled with it so much and what to say and what to bring to you. Even when we think we have it figured out, there's still part of the process is walking through the ground that sometimes is steep, is sometimes uphill, to find the kernel of what the Spirit might illuminate to us. So to start out, a few years ago, I used to live in Salem, Oregon. And there was this one summer evening where around 5 o'clock, an emergency text went to everyone in the city, and it was super vague, super vague. It was basically like, state of emergency, details to follow. I'm like, what is a TBD emergency text? What the heck? Now, I have a degree in film production, so I've watched too many movies to receive a text like this and not have my imagination run wild. I imagined everything from a nuclear holocaust to aliens landing to even wondering if maybe it was a zombie occurrence. And it took a few hours, so it was just in there. What is going on? When will we find out? And well, finally, another text came in, and what was happening was less exciting than aliens, unfortunately. But what was happening is that the main reservoir that water, like supplied water to the city, had toxic algae blooms in it. And so this text clarified that that was what was going on, and anyone who was a very young child, an elderly person, or a pregnant woman should not drink this water. But as now we've probably learned from the pandemic, as soon as you tell people something like toxic algae bloom juice is coming out of your faucet, nobody wants to drink that water anymore. Within hours, bottled water flew off the shelf, and it didn't really impact my life at all. But my younger sister was pregnant with her first child. And as a new mom to be, she wanted to do everything right. And now she couldn't find water to drink. Her and her husband drove 30 miles away trying to find some bottled water before finally the National Guard came in and set up water stations at schools so that people who were vulnerable or picky could get clean water. And while it's a funny aside, it reminds me how easily we take for granted our easy access to water. As soon as something throws question into that, chaos ensues, and we're reminded that we're a lot more vulnerable than we actually believe we are. And so for the woman at the well, her access to water was something she could never take for granted. It was always labor. And yet it's interesting that through a few centuries or so, we think that we as people who sit 2,000 years later think that we understand what it was like for women to get water, and when they got water and how they got water, what that might be saying about them. Maybe you're like me and you've heard similar teachings on the Samaritan woman at the well. I've always heard it with assumptions after assumptions, reducing this woman and her contribution to our shared faith to something that really flattens who she is and what she has to contribute. I've heard her called a prostitute, an adulteress. I've heard her fleshed out with all of the ways that she is a fallen woman. But none of those descriptors actually appear in the text. And usually when those descriptors do, it's pretty clear. When we don't have anything to go on, it's not fair for us to color in the lines of who someone is with information that we don't have. But yet the woman at the well, like so many women that appear on the pages of the Bible, has often had to bear the weight of thousands of years of patriarchal perceptions. And these perceptions often turn these women and their stories into two-dimensional versions of themselves. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that I can undo in one single sermon thousands of years of patriarchal thinking. but I'm hoping together we can hold this woman and her story with humility, with an awareness of vulnerability, so that we might learn from her experience. I have to admit that when I started researching for this sermon, I struggled to condense everything down. Much like Jacob's well is very deep, so too is this story, and there is so much going on culturally, historically, literary. It's a very rich passage. And I found the only way I could find focus for my sermon was to try to center my sermon on the perspective of the Samaritan woman. So let's start there. It's noon, and this woman, like many women of her time, has likely been up for hours. She's been doing household tasks. There's a chance she may have already been at the well once already. But for whatever reason, as household work that women did often required lots of water, she has to go back. I wonder if maybe she knocked over her water jar earlier in the morning. I don't know if you've ever done that, where you have this chore and you just keep messing it up so it takes longer and longer and longer. It's like that second trip to the grocery store or that third trip to Home Depot. And so I wonder if she was just annoyed with herself and she's like, okay, fine, I have to go to the well, but at least it's noon. I'm not going to have to talk to anyone. Oh, wait, there's a stranger. And something to be aware of in this culture is that men and women who weren't married or related, they did not talk to each other. And so maybe she needed the water so bad she hoped that this stranger wouldn't talk to her. But alas, she was not that lucky. That stranger doesn't even ask for her hospitality, but commands it of her. And it's almost like she realizes three fundamental truths at the exact same time. Thank you for the Hamilton fans. But Jesus and this woman, they are divided not only by their gender, but also by their ethnicity and their religion. And so her response to him, how is it that you can ask a drink of me, a Samaritan woman? It touches on this whole backstory. And so I'm going to do my best to give you the briefest summary of a few hundred years of Old Testament history. Bear with me. So, the kingdom of Israel split into two kingdoms in the Old Testament. The northern kingdom continued to be called Israel, and the southern kingdom was called Judah. And there's this period of time where God sends prophet after prophet to both of these nations, encouraging them to repent and to return to the tenets of their faith. And the northern kingdom was conquered first by the Assyrians. And so the people of Israel had three choices. They were either exiled, some of them fled to Judah, and others stayed behind. And for that remnant that stayed behind, they kind of intermingled with all of these other people that the Assyrian Empire brought in to help settle their newly conquered land. And then a few hundred years later, the kingdom of Judah falls by the Babylonians, and it's a similar thing. People are left behind. People are also exiled. And for the people of Judah, there was such lament at their failings at the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of their temple, that they clung to the faith in the way that they hadn't before. And so when they returned from exile, there were two groups of people. There were those who had remained faithful, and there were those who had, their values and their religion had been intermixed with other cultures. And so the Samaritans were viewed by the Jews as people who did not keep the covenant. Similarly, the Samaritans thought that they were the true chosen people. And so both of these have a common ancestry, but they've grown apart in years of exile and the hundreds of years between the Old Testament and the New Testament. It got so bad that at one point a Jewish leader destroyed the Samaritan temple. And the Samaritans retaliated by coming to Jerusalem and desecrating the temple. And so Jews barred Samaritans from even worshiping in their temple. But these two people couldn't really escape each other in some ways. There were two kind of main areas where the Jews were settled: Galilee in the north, Judea in the south, and right in the middle was Samaria, where the Samaritans were. And so most Jews actually took the long way to Galilee to just completely avoid the Samaritans altogether. But it went further than that. The Jews also considered that the Samaritans were unclean, meaning that an act of sharing a meal, a jar of water, it made a Jew unclean. So it was no small thing for Jesus to ask a Samaritan woman for water. And she knew that. Her words hit me sort of like, "My guy, I don't know that much about you, but you are a Jewish man, and you're not even a good Jew if you're wandering around Samaria asking me, a Samaritan woman, for water." From her perspective, I think her response is warranted. She knows the backstory of these two people. She may have experienced prejudice herself. She may have been aware that before she even said a word, she would be judged as unclean. But Jesus doesn't give her a typical response. Instead of kind of following up with her denial of hospitality, he instead tells her about living water. Now, for us, this metaphor is probably really beautiful, but I wonder if for the woman it sounded a little bizarre. She maybe wasn't familiar with this metaphor. And as the conversation continues, we can see in real time that she is trying to grasp and understand, what is this water? What is this spiritual reality that this man is telling me about? And so I imagine that if I had to walk a mile or more every day, maybe once, twice, three times a day for water, that maybe I would want a water that never caused me to be thirsty again. It makes sense that as she's trying to figure out this spiritual reality, she sees that maybe there's something that would cut down on her time, her labor, her need, her daily walk to the well. But that's not what Jesus is offering. And now this is the part of the story where the conversation, in my mind, takes a pretty sharp narrative turn. And it's a turn that is hard to look at. Jesus asks her to go bring her husband. And their conversation reveals that not only does she not have a husband, she has had five husbands in her life. In her current domestic situation, she's living in a house with a man where they're not married. The text isn't clear at all, the story behind her many husbands. But certainly it was uncommon for a woman to have five husbands. But also, I'd like to point out that this was a woman living in a patriarchal system where she may have had little choice. Marriage for women was sometimes the only opportunity for economic stability. Because women were married quite young, they often outlived one, maybe even two husbands. There's a good chance that she was widowed. And as for divorce, it's possible, but it would be unlikely that she was able, without the support of a father or a male relative, to successfully petition divorce in her time. But it's likely that she was divorced. The text also isn't clear about her current living situation. We don't know if the man she's living with is an adult son or a male relative. There's a lot that this doesn't tell us. And I can't really say with any certainty, this was her life, this is what she experienced. I can't tell you that there's no way she wasn't guilty of adultery. You've likely heard, though, that she was adulterous, that she was so ostracized by her community that she needed to go get water at the hottest part of the day to avoid any contact with those who would reject her. For women in this period, so much of their worth was put in filling the role of wife and mother. And for centuries, scholars have misaligned the Samaritan woman because she did not fit neatly into these boxes of wife and mother. She wasn't what they expected a woman to be. So here we have a woman who does not turn away when a stranger demands hospitality of her, but she instead asks questions. And it's so interesting to me, we see her natural curiosity come out in the text, but so often we're quick to come to judgments, to come to certainty about who she was, instead of following her example and being a little bit curious. And I would like to be curious with her, but then I feel like I still kind of struggle to be curious with the story itself, curious with these two verses in the Bible that have misaligned this woman for so many years. On the surface, they appear to be shaming or judgmental, shaming of a woman who has likely experienced a lifetime of disappointments and hardships and vulnerabilities. So what was Jesus doing? Was he judging her as one of the worst sinners? Or was he simply acknowledging her story? If John hadn't recorded this woman's response or her words when she returns back to her community, I might believe that these words are judgmental or shaming. But to be curious, I have to ask myself, how might these words have sounded to the Samaritan woman? Her response suggests that she didn't take it negatively. She responds by naming Jesus as a prophet, which maybe seems like a small thing, as Jesus was unique and many people saw that in him. But for the Samaritans, they didn't believe that there had been a prophet since Moses. So for her to name Jesus as a prophet is something pretty extraordinary. And so I wonder if she heard his words more as, "I know your story. I see the hardships you faced. I see your suffering. I see all you've done to overcome, to keep going, to keep living. I see you." In her openness, she allows Jesus to see her. And in turn, she is given the opportunity to see something in Jesus. The Samaritans were waiting for a messianic figure as well. They called this Messiah that they waited for Taheb, the one who restores. And so as Jesus tells her of this coming day when true believers will worship God not in a special place, not just in the temple in Jerusalem, but in spirit and truth, it touches on perhaps a deeper longing for restoration. Here she says this statement, "I know the Messiah is coming," and Jesus gives her a gift in his response, saying, "I am he." Jesus does not make this disclosure often. It's interesting because there's a thread of hospitality that runs through this entire narrative, but it doesn't show up in the way that we think. The woman doesn't immediately give Jesus water. Though this conversation, both Jesus and the woman enter into a place of shared vulnerability where a spiritual hospitality can take place. The woman is open with Jesus, and that openness allows her to not only work out her faith in real time, but to also be known in the process. And Jesus responds to that gift by allowing himself to be known to her. Being truly known is not just a one-way street. It's a shared gift. And these people who enter this interaction separated by gender, ethnicity, and religion walk away no longer being the other. And it's a beautiful interaction that ripples and vibrates out. Jesus walks into Samaria, and he announces that the kingdom of God is near for all people. But he does this by talking to a woman and trusting in her testimony. The testimony that she gives to her community is one of being known. That in her experience of being known, she is able to marvel and grasp that Jesus is the Messiah. And it should be noted as well that her community believes her. And while this story ends in this place of evangelism with an entire community coming to recognize Jesus, to be honest, I struggled to really discern what Jesus might be illuminating to me to bring here. I arrived at this text pretty parched, pretty weary. And I know that many of us can empathize and relate to the many disappointments and losses, the weariness and the frustration that this season keeps delivering over and over again to our doors. I've lived here for almost 3 years now, and I moved here after leaving a painful ministry setting. I kind of thought that Chicago and going to seminary would be this fresh start, that all of the pain that I left behind would just stay there. And so this season turned out to be the wilderness part two. It was not the sequel that I had in mind for myself, to say the least. And if I'm honest, I, like this woman, would very much like a Jesus-branded water that would make my physical life easier. It's easy to lose pieces of myself to the stress, to the lament, to the suffering. It's easy to get lost sometimes navigating our own lives, where we can become strangers even to ourselves. And so this text challenged me. Do I really believe that the spiritual water, the living water that Jesus offered this woman was better? Because similar to how this woman has so often been misunderstood, I think that the metaphor of living water has as well. I've heard it so many times in my life. It's in songs, it's in devotional books, on journals that people have given me over my life. It kind of feels like a simple platitude, like one of those things that we say to each other. And yet still connected to this passage, to Jesus and this woman, is living water. And so her experience of this water took follow-up questions. It took maybe a little bit of sass, but also an openness and a hospitality to herself, to the moment, and to Jesus. In this meeting, something was exchanged, something that was precious. So precious that this woman left her water jar, the very reason she came to the well in the first place, to bring her experience back to her community. And I come away from this passage in simple awe of this woman and her openness to be known. I'm a middle child. There's four of us in my family, so I say I'm a true middle child. I can explain afterwards. I'm sure that this is a stereotype that goes beyond middle children, but I feel like my birthright is to constantly feel misunderstood. And it's probably something that we all experience. But one pattern that I see so often in my life is this deep longing and desire to be truly known and the pain of being misunderstood. And the desire grows, but so does the fear sometimes, so that when anyone gets close enough to know me, I totally freak out. I shrink back and I shrink away. Our vulnerability in this world is not always seen as a gift. And likely we all have stories where we've trusted people, we've let them in, we've allowed ourselves to be known, and we've been let down. And I think the Samaritan woman probably could personally relate and empathize through her own similar experiences. And what I found in this passage was almost her voice echoing out to me, "Kat, when was the last time you let yourself be known?" So what exactly do I mean by the simple concept of being known? I think we see in the passage that being known by God, that it's not something that we know here. We know that being known by other humans, it's something that is so fragile it can break. But when Jesus knows us, when we allow ourselves to be known by the one who loves us dearly, it's like water, living water. It doesn't break. It springs up in surprising places. It's deep. And while rivers and springs here on earth can run dry, this knowingness, this living water that Jesus brings, it never does. This water that Jesus brings can spring up in the driest of seasons, and it can soothe. And I think that when we allow ourselves to accept this water, to accept being known, it can heal. And I know that being known probably seems like a relatively simple takeaway from this passage, It's not big and splashy, but it's rather small and interpersonal. And it would be tempting, right, to use this story like a formula. God meets a woman. She accepts his water. She becomes known. She returns to her village and saves everyone. As if the point of being known is just to leverage it for bigger and bigger outcomes. And the story does have these beautiful ripples. Being known impacts her entire community. But it's firmly rooted in this simple act between two people, being hospitable to each other and being willing to be known and seen by one another. I see in this story an opportunity to check in, to recalibrate, to reconnect back to the one who knows us. Like I said, I came to this passage feeling parched, thirsty, and weary myself. And in reading it, I find that there is an oasis, there is a spring that is waiting for me. And it's scary to let down our guards, to be vulnerable. It's scary to accept the gifts that Jesus offers. It's scary to let our pain slip away and stop holding us back. It is a simple reality, but sometimes it's the simple realities that we need most. The invitation to come back to where we can find living water, drink anew, and be known in Christ again. Thank you.